Well, this is the last of our little mini-series of five. And so for this morning, I thought what would be appropriate for us to do is, because we are already into Advent, to talk about one particular aspect of the Christmas story that I have spent a great deal of time working on, and I think you may find of interest. And this is the story of the birth of Jesus itself. I began my research and study of the question when all of a sudden I realized that in Luke chapter 2, verse 7, where we have the 6 and 7, we have the account of the birth of Jesus, that we're told in verse, verse 4, that they went up from Galilee to Nazareth. Namely, they arrived in verse 4, and then in verse 6 it says, and while they were there, her days, plural, were fulfilled. Okay, so where was Mary during the last stages of her pregnancy? Beg your pardon?
Traveling.
In Jerusalem.
Let's read the text again. While they were there in Bethlehem, her days, plural, were fulfilled, meaning she completed the last stages of her pregnancy. So where did it happen? Bethlehem. Well, I all of a sudden realized this, and then I said to myself, I've been brainwashed by the Christmas stories that the little kids put on Sunday school for all of my life. Because the little Christmas stories always tell us that Jesus is born the night they arrive. And then I said to myself, well, now, just a minute. You know, we read this text, and then we enact a little Christmas pageant which violates what the text is saying, and nobody sticks up their hand and says, hey, the play you just gave us doesn't fit the text you just read. Nobody does that. And so then I began working on this, and I call this the late night arrival myth. So Mary and Joseph are in Bethlehem, let's say a month. The last stages of her pregnancy would be what? I mean, you know, it's pretty difficult for a woman to walk anywhere in the last week of her pregnancy, let alone go off on a three-day journey, either on a donkey or walking. So let's assume a month. That would be, I think, probably 2 weeks. All right, 2 weeks. They're in Bethlehem for an extended period before the baby is born. Now, if this is the case, is Joseph so stupid that he cannot manage to arrange anything in a period of a month? Keep in mind the fact that she has relatives in the hill country of Judea, Elizabeth. She has just visited her relatives. She was warmly welcomed by Elizabeth. And she knows that she will be welcomed back. And by the time you get to Bethlehem, you are within a 2-hour donkey ride of any village of the hill country of Judea. So if there is no shelter to be found in Bethlehem, what is going to happen? They are going to zip, zip, zip off to her relatives, and her relatives will take care of the family. And if they don't go to the relatives, and they end up in this drafty, cold stable with this mean old innkeeper, what has Joseph done in terms of his relationships to his in-laws for the rest of his life? You know, he's really created a problem. Furthermore, the accounts which we have about Joseph, brief though they are, show us a man of courage and of integrity and of compassion and some, you know, someone who can manage. And so, you know, are we really painting a picture in which we have this fellow who really can't manage anything, and he is so stupid that give him a month and he can't even find shelter for his wife? Furthermore, I said to myself as I began looking at the account, I discovered that what we have here is a story of a Middle Easterner returning to their home village. Joseph knows the genealogy. All he has to say is, I am so-and-so, son of so-and-so, son of so-and-so, son of so-and-so. Oh, yes, of course, your
grandfather left one up north. Oh, how are you? My, it's good to see you. Where have you been? Every home in the village will be open to him. Every home. And he is a descendant of the most famous family the village ever produced. He is of the House of David. We know that the House of David survived in Bethlehem because after the fall of Jerusalem, the Romans found a few of them in Bethlehem, dragged them in, wondering whether or not these might be political pretenders of some kind of threat to Roman rule. And they were simple peasant folk, and Titus said, these people aren't going to give us any trouble, let them go. So they let them go, but they were still there. There were descendants of the house of David in Bethlehem in the year 70. So if there were, we have from Josephus, a Jewish historian of the first century, a contemporary of these of those events. So if there were members of the house of David in the year 70, there were certainly members of the house of David 70 years before that. Namely, Joseph has relatives himself in town, and their homes will also be open to him. Furthermore, what happens to a woman who is about to give birth in peasant society, anywhere in the world in particular, and in the Middle East in particular? I mean, you know, to turn out a woman who is about to give birth in Middle Eastern village society is unthinkable. I mean, it is absolutely unthinkable that she would be turned out. So I began to focus my mind on what are we going to do with our little problem of the mythologies which we have created around the Christmas story. One is the late night arrival myth. The second is the idea that there were three wise men. The text says there were three different kinds of gifts. You have a Christmas party at the office. What kind of gifts were exchanged? Well, small items of clothing, knickknacks, and office supplies. Oh, so you only have three people in your office. No, there were three kinds of gifts. Three kinds of gifts doesn't mean three people in the office. So the kinds of gifts that were given to Jesus were gold, frankincense, and myrrh. It says nothing about how many people gave them. There could have been 15 wise men. But you see, we are very sure, very, very, very sure, the text tells us that there are three wise men, because that's all we've known all our lives. We're also very sure that he was born at night. Where actually the shepherds say, this day he was born to you. Now, if the angels are talking in Roman time, it would have been in the daytime. If they are talking Jewish time, and then the day, of course, started at sundown, and so you could say, well, yes, it's after sundown because it's this day and the day starts at sundown. So, okay, he could have been born at night. We won't press that one. Another myth is that he was born in winter. Now, this one I'm quite confident of because having lived in Bethlehem for 5 years, I know perfectly well that shepherds take their sheep and spend the night out in the countryside from the middle of May through September. By the middle of October, the weather here is roughly the same as it is there, and it's colder there because you're 2,500 feet up. It is too cold, and you can't spend overnight out in the fields. You see that your sheep get back to the village, and you sleep in your bed. Come late May, okay, it's warm enough. You can get a little bit farther away, and you can spend the night out in the fields. So Jesus is born sometime between the middle of May and the end of September. Now, how did we get this funny idea that he was born in the middle of winter? Well, the story is told, that probably true, that many of the early Christians, which was the count, that's fair enough, were servants and slaves, and so the 25th of December was given to them as a festival of light by the Romans whom were their masters, and so this is the day we have off, so we're all free on this day, so we will celebrate the birth of Jesus. That's part of it, but they had many other vacations, and so there had to have been a reason why they picked this particular one, and I think the reason is that this was the first day they had off after the winter, what's the word?
Solstice,
that's it. After the winter solstice, this is the first day they had off, and so, you know, the days are getting shorter and shorter, and the night is getting longer and longer, and it looks like darkness is going to win. And then all of a sudden, this miracle happens on the 21st of December, that all of a sudden the light begins to win over the darkness. An early Christian said, we've got a day off every 10 days or so, all year long, but the day we're going to pick for the celebration of the birth of Jesus is the day closest to the point at which the light begins to win over the darkness. So I think that's beautiful. And so if somebody came along with absolute historical proof that Jesus was born on the 16th of July, I would still want to celebrate on the 25th of December because of this fact. Okay, so that one I don't have any problem with at all, even though I'm quite sure he was born in the summer. The text tells us no hint at all, except this one, that the shepherds are in the fields, which tells us that it's happening in the summer. All right, now back to our basic problem of what about the way we look at the birth of Jesus himself? What is to be done is to try and solve this. Well, he's of the house of David. She has relatives nearby. They're in Bethlehem society. Oh, yes, the shepherds. The shepherds come, and we are told that after they visit the Holy Family, that they go home praising God for all that they had seen and heard. Now, the all includes, obviously, the quality of the hospitality. Being good Middle Easterners, wanting to show honor to the Holy Family, if they found them in this cold, crafty stable, shut out by this mean old innkeeper manure all over the floor, what are these shepherds going to do when they visit them in this kind of surroundings? We have some Middle Easterners among us. What will the shepherds do?
Take them home.
Take them home, of course. This is outrageous. Come home with us. Now, they don't. They find the quality of the hospitality fully acceptable. They go home praising God for all that they have seen and heard, which includes the family is well taken care of. We can't do any better. They're satisfied. Okay, so now what on earth, how are we going to try and sort this out? The mythology which we have obviously has to be set aside, but what is the story in fact telling us? Well, my quest led to two things. First was to study the word kataluma, and this is the word which we have traditionally translated as in our text. There was no room for them in the inn, and the Greek word kataluma, right? Okay, so what is a kataluma? Well, one of the ways that we use... It's not enough just to look up the word in a Greek dictionary, because you see, the people are doing the writing. Ah, yes, I forgot to mention that. There are five items in the story which tell us that this is a story written by Palestinians. First of all, we're told that they went up from Nazareth to Jerusalem. Aha. The author has his geography correct. Both of these towns are on a ridge, but Jerusalem is in fact higher than Nazareth. So you're going along the top of the ridge, but you are in fact gradually going up. So he's got it straight. Not everybody does when they write about these things. And second thing, we had noticed that the town is called the City of David, which is called Bethlehem. You've mentioned the name of the place twice. Now, the phrase City of David is very, very puzzling, because in the Old Testament, the City of David is always the oldest part of the city of Jerusalem. It's called the City of David. The little bit, the sort of City of Jerusalem is kind of like a hand. You've got a thumb out here, and that's where the city was first started to be built, and that's called the City of David. And then the temple area is up here, and then the find of the city in large. So how come we've got the City of David applied to another town? Well, Middle Eastern tradition, often they take the name of a town, and local folks know the name of the town on the basis of the most famous person who came out of the town. This is the city of so-and-so, and you name some very, very famous person whom the town produced. So local folks quite likely in the first century knew this as the city of David, but if you look it up on a map, you're not going to find the city of David referring to Bethlehem. And so somebody puts in a little note which says, which is called Bethlehem. Ah, that you'll find on the map. Somebody is adding a note to an older text. Somebody is trying to clarify the use of the material in a culture which doesn't understand where the city of David is. Namely, probably Luke is adding a little footnote for Theophilus, the Greek for whom he's composing his gospel, so that Theophilus will be able to understand where this story took place. Luke is very cautious and very conservative. He doesn't change it. He doesn't cross out what is there. He merely adds a little footnote. I'm delighted to find the little footnote, because that means that we're dealing with a text that is on two literary layers. You have somebody who wrote the text, and then you have somebody who's now trying to take that material and have it make sense for somebody in another culture, and they know they've got to add a little bit of an explanation to it. And so Luke already has an old story, and it's a story written by Palestinian Jews for Palestinian Jews. Then the third thing we notice is that it says the house and lineage of David. Again, you've said it twice. The house of David, if you are a Middle Easterner, means the family of David. But if you are a Westerner, a Latin or a Greek, the house of David means a building. So again, Luke wants to be very sure that Theophilus doesn't misunderstand him. And so his text in front of him, the tradition which has come to him, says the house of David, the way in Semitic culture you refer to an extended family, the house of so-and-so. And so he again adds a little tiny note to be sure that a non-Semitic person will understand what it's all about. Then also we notice that that the child is wrapped. Palestinian peasant folks still do this. When a child is born, after the child is washed, then it's rubbed with salt to purify it, quote-unquote. But I'm not quite sure I understand that. But then the child is wrapped, and they take long bands of material, and just it looks kind of like a mummy. Did you ever notice the fact that all the medieval paintings of the birth of Jesus, the child is always naked, even though the text says the child is wrapped? This blows my mind, you know, just how on earth those Italians always drew the child naked when we got a text in front of us that says he was completely wrapped up. But there we are. Not much we can do about that. So the wrapped bit, we have this in the 16th chapter of Ezekiel. So it's an old custom, and village people still do it today in Syria and Lebanon and in Palestine. I have asked them why they do this, and they say it makes the kid's limbs grow straight. Well, I don't think that's the reason. I think the reason is they find out that the child is quieted. Being in the confinement of the womb, all of a sudden there's too much freedom out here, an environment the child is totally disoriented in, and when you wrap the child up, then it relaxes and goes to sleep. I've had nurses tell me that a very, very newborn child, the best thing to do is to wrap it fairly tightly in the blanket, and it relaxes much more quickly and goes to sleep much more easily. Well, Middle Eastern village people have discovered this, and so the child is wrapped. We have only one reference in the Old Testament. This is the only reference in the New Testament, the wrapping of a child. It is an authentic Middle Eastern custom, and here it is reflected in the text. Okay, so, and then there is the importance of it being of the family of David. We call this a Davidic Christology informs the text. That is, a concern to identify the person of Jesus with the family of David is important for the person who initially wrote up the text. So we've got five reasons to say that this text is not a story written up by a Greek Christian a generation after the time of Jesus for Greek readers. No, it is written up by a Jewish Palestinian Christian for Jewish Palestinian readers at a very early stage in the life of the church. Thereby, it is into Middle Eastern Semitic culture that we have to look to try and get the keys to what this story is all about. Okay, so our first real serious question here is, what about this kataluma? This is not the ordinary Greek word for an inn. There's another word, and the word is pandocheion. Pan, all, docheo, to receive. the place that receives everybody. Luke knows this word. He uses it. He uses it in the 10th chapter of his gospel when he has the story of the Good Samaritan, who ends up at a commercial inn. They go to a pandohia. This word has gone into Turkish, it's gone into Arabic, it has gone into Armenian, it's gone into Coptic, it's gone into Arabic. Funduk, it comes out in Arabic. The common Arabic word for a commercial establishment where you pay money and spend the night. And it's the Greek word that shows up in the story of the Good Samaritan. So Luke has this word in his vocabulary. He uses it. He uses it in the gospel. But here, it's another word. Kataluma. A very general word, which if you look it up in Greek usage, it merely means a place to stay. Sometimes when we have words that are kind of general and we wonder if they have specific meanings, we look to see, does this word in Greek translate in the Greek Old Testament special words in the Hebrew Old Testament? What are the Hebrew equivalents behind it? And by going back to the Hebrew Old Testament through the Greek Old Testament, we can help ourselves out. Unfortunately, when you do this with the word kataluma, you end up with 11 different words, so it's hopeless. Everything from a place where a lion finds shelter in a cave somewhere to the three that are of interest to us. One is a private home, one is a commercial inn, and one is a guest room attached to a private home. Those three are also translations out of Hebrew into Greek that use the word kataluma. So we really don't go anywhere. I tried that, didn't help. So then the next question is, do we find the word kataluma used anywhere else in the Gospels in general, and do we find it used anywhere else by Luke in particular? And the answer is yes. There is one other time in the Gospels in which the word kataluma shows up. And this is the account in the 22nd chapter of Luke, in the 11th verse, where Jesus says to the disciples on the eve of the Passover, he says, follow a man carrying a pitcher of water. This is in the old city of Jerusalem. And when he enters the house, ask the house owner, where is the kataluma, that I may have the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room furnished. What is a kataluma now? We have it defined.
Reception
room? Guest room? Some kind of a special room that is attached to a private dwelling. The word guest room would be fine. We know for receptions, for overnight guests, whatever. It's a special room used for guests. Now, if we take this meaning and apply it, it will be important for us. Now, the second question that obviously has to be asked is, well, what's this bit about mangers? Because we're told that they put the child in a manger. Well, here's the point at which we in the West have taken our own Western culture and superimposed it on the text. Because for us, mangers are always in stables and barns, which are buildings that are separated from the building in which the family lives. Aha! But in traditional Palestinian and Lebanese, I've not seen this in Syrian or Jordanian homes, but I have seen them in southern Lebanese, Upper Galilee in the first century, and I've seen many of them in Palestine, and I know them also from Iron II excavations, that is from the time of David. And this is that the one-room traditional village home, if you look at it from the top, it's like this. If you look at it from the side, it's like this. Here comes the mountainside down. You cut out a bit of the mountainside. You build up, you lay your foundation, build up your walls. And inside, you put in a large raised terrace, which is about a meter high than the rest of the floor. And this is called El Mastaba in Arabic. The door is down on the lower level. There is then the stairs which go up to the upper level. So here you are looking at it from the top. Here is where you come in. Here are the stairs. This is the area in which the family lives and sleeps and cooks and entertains guests and all sorts of things. And there is a certain slope to the floor. And when the house is built, there's a word for it. I'm sorry, I can't remember it. But I was told this by village builders, that there is always a slope to the floor, and the builder always asks the people, how much slope do you want? The point is, obviously, when you're going to wash the floor down, you start up here, and everything washes down into this area, and then goes out the door. And so, and Jesus talks about when you go into a house, don't sit in the most honored place, sit lower down, and someone will say to you, come up higher. It's literally higher, because this is where Grandpa's going to sit up here, and then the honored guests will sit up with him, and lesser folks will sit along here. So when you come in, you know, be polite, sit down somewhere near the door, and they will tell you, come up higher. Alright, so this is where we are. Now, what happens in this kind of a home? Why the lower area? Every village family has two or three sheep and a donkey and a cow. The cow is the protein supply for the family. The donkey is the transportation system. And the sheep are the winter clothing. So every family must have it. And so what you do is the last thing at night, you bring these animals in. The first thing in the morning, you open the door and you lead them out to the courtyard. And you tie them up, clean up any droppings over the night, and the house is ready for the day. Now, what if Betsy in the middle of the night gets hungry? Well, dug out of the floor at the lower end of the living space are mangers. You won't be disturbed because the cow will have something to eat. Then the question obviously becomes, you know, doesn't everybody have mangers in the living room? I mean, you know, this is just the way you build your house. I've been in homes like this. I've been entertained in homes like this. There is one home like this that is still lived in that is about 150 meters from the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. And two winters ago, the independent commercial British broadcasting people got hold of me. They found out that I had, I don't know how they did it, but they got a hold of the fact that I had some new ideas on the Christmas story. And they were going to have a documentary of me telling the story of how this all happened, standing in that kind of a home. And the producer and his cameraman came out, and we made contact with the family. Everything was all set up, and then there was a strike, and they ran out of money, and they didn't come. They promised me 6 million viewers in England, so I didn't get to talk to those 6 million, so I'll talk to you. That's all. This is quite good enough. And so here is the story I would have told to the English countryside a year ago Christmas had I been given the opportunity. So where are we? Yes, well, here you bring the cow in at night and you take them out in the daytime. Now, do we have any evidence of this one-room home in biblical literature? Answer, yes. In the Old Testament, we're told that Saul is getting very, very discouraged, and he's visiting the old translation, Witch of Endor, new translation, Medium of Endor, whichever word you prefer, and she knows that his problem is that his blood sugar has dropped too far, and so he won't eat. He refuses. He's depressed. So the story says she took a calf from within the house, butchered it, and made a meal for the king, and he ate. I mean, doesn't everybody have a calf in the house? Okay. Then the second story is the story of Jephthah the Gileadite. If you remember this story, this is a story of a man who makes a play. He's going off to fight a war, and he makes a pledge to God that when he comes home early in the morning, the first thing he sees coming out of his house, if God gives him victory, he will offer the first thing that appears out of the door of his house on his return as a sacrifice. He goes away, he is victorious, he comes back, and the first thing that comes out, first thing in the morning, is his daughter. Tragedy. He is obliged to sacrifice his daughter. Now, why is it a tragedy? I mean, what did he expect? His father? Grandfather? Wife? What did he expect? He didn't think it was going to be a person at all. He thought it was going to be one of the animals of the house. I mean, you open the door and they all run out. And that's the scene that happens every morning, and he thinks that's what's going to happen, and, you know, it's happened every morning that he can remember, and so either the battle is going to be fought at night, and he's going to walk all night, and he's going to show up early, or it's going to be fought the previous day. In any case, he's going to show up first thing in the morning, and he's going to watch this little morning ceremony, and the animals run out, and the first one out, he will offer a sacrifice, and to his utter horror, this particular morning, the first thing out is his daughter. The tragedy only makes sense, and the vow itself only makes sense if you know he has animals in the house. Okay, New Testament. Jesus says, our older translation says, this is in the Sermon on the Mount, says, nor do men light a lamp and put it on a lampstand. But actually the Greek says, nor do they light a lamp. The ladies are correct. This is a sexist translation. The word men is not in the text. Who do you think lights lamps in Jewish homes?
The women.
The women, yeah. So Jesus has two stories. One is about the building of towns. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. That's something men do. Nor do they light a lamp, obviously the women. So he's got a nice balance there, which we ordinarily miss, but never mind. The point is that the light shows light to all who are in the house. One lamp. How many rooms in this house?
One.
One. In the 13th chapter of Luke, Jesus has a confrontation with the head of the synagogue. There's a woman in the synagogue who we're told is bent over. The word is she's got back problems, and the word is that she's all tied up. And so Jesus calls her in the synagogue, and the Greek word is he unties her, and she's able to stand up. Head of the synagogue gets upset. He says, you're engaged in medical procedures on Shabbat, and this is against the law. You're not supposed to work on Shabbat. Don't open the clinic on Shabbat. And so Jesus eyeballs it with him and says, this morning you untied your donkey and led it out into the courtyard. And you're going to complain about my untying this woman? Now, if the head of the synagogue, he's now been confronted in front of his own people, if he has a stable, he is going to answer, I never touch the animals on Shabbat. But the text tells us that he is speechless. He's unable to say anything. Why? Because if he says, I always leave the cow in the living room all day long, everybody's going to, this is hilarious. I mean, everybody knows that this is culturally unacceptable. And so the rabbis, when they came to make rules about what you can and cannot do in Shabbat, this is in the tractate on Shabbat in the Talmud, which I read through with interest just a few months ago. And it talks about, yes, well, okay, you're allowed to take the cow out on Shabbat and tie it up in the courtyard, but can you take the hay that's in the manger in the house and take it out for it to eat outside? No, you can't touch the hay. That's work. But we will let you take the cow out. So, you know, they made certain allowances for sort of the very important aspects of traditional culture. In what you can and cannot do on Shabbat. Well, again, obviously, the cow is in the living room. All right. Now, very interestingly, that there is a German. His name is Gustav Dahlmann, and he went to Palestine in about 1875, something like that, lived there through to the First World War, ended up publishing eight volumes called Arbeit und Sitte in Palestina, Life and Work in Palestine. Unfortunately, never translated out of German. But marvelous documentation of all the nitty-gritty bits and pieces of peasant life in Palestine under Turkish occupation before the coming of the modern age. And he's got a whole book on houses, and he's got 92 diagrams showing village homes, and they all have mangers in the living room. Now, many of these houses also have attached to them, either on the roof or at the side, a guest room. The guest room is there and opened only when you have guests. Luke specifically tells us Cataluma is a guest room. That's the name of the room where the upper room took place. Mangers are in the living room. Okay. The text is written for Palestinians in the first century. And the text says, she brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger. And the reader says, manger? They're in the living room. Why didn't this family that entertained them open the guest room for them? Wouldn't that have been nicer? The text answers the question. Because there was no room for them in the guest room. Oh, they have other guests. Oh, yes. Well, the living room is fine. It's nicer anyway. It's bigger. There's a dip in the floor. The family wasn't expecting a baby. The family that lives there, they don't have a cradle. And so, well, you've got this nice little dip in the floor. You can clean it out, put some blankets down there, and find that the baby won't roll out. It's perfectly safe. Everybody can move an awe at it, and so on. The village midwife is there. When you see it this way, every scrap of cultural and textual and historical information falls into place. Jesus goes to Bethlehem. She doesn't need to go to her relatives because Joseph's relatives are all over town. They are welcomed into a peasant home. And when the shepherds are told this fact that the child has been born, they're nervous. They don't want to go because shepherds were considered unclean. They were proscribed traits. We talked about that last week. And we talked about the fact that the message first comes to them. So they're afraid they're going to be told, tradesmen to the back door, please. And the angel says, this will be a sign for you. You will find the babe wrapped. That's what we do to our kids. Lying in a manger. Oh, he's in a one-room home like ours. Maybe they won't say to us, tradesmen to the back door, please. And they go. Because he is born for the likes of us. Any comment or question?
When they stay in this house until the Magi come a year or so later?
We don't know when the Magi come. Matthew tells us the Magi came to the house. Of course, they're living in a house. You see, we've had to create... Joseph finally got his act together and rented a house somewhere. He couldn't manage while the last month, but after the child is born, he did finally manage to find something. No, you don't have to do that. They're in the house in the beginning. You don't have to imagine that they have moved someplace in order to have the Magi show up in the house. How did they get out? Oh, yeah. Oh, it's another part is that we have not the slightest scrap of evidence that the city of Bethlehem had an inn. Now, there could have been one, but generally inns are in places where you have lots of travelers going through that are going to need an inn. No, this town doesn't have travelers going through, and there's not the slightest scrap of information that there was ever an inn in Bethlehem. This is a little dinky, off the road place. If you Bethlehem, Jerusalem, of course you would have inns. Of course, Caesarea, by all means. Jericho, yes, international highway going through it. Of course, there would be Bethlehem. Who would want to go out of money by building an inn in Bethlehem? But that's irrelevant. Whether there was or was not, the point is the place where he is born. There are mangers, and everybody knows that mangers are in the living room. Okay.
I was confused by the nakedness of the name of Jesus, but in an art history class I took in college, we were studying about the Renaissance art, which is where this usually happens,
yes.
And the use of the triangle and all this stuff. And one of the things that they had said, or I've written in the text, right, art history text, was that the Italians purposefully unwrapped the baby Jesus to prove that God didn't appear as a manifestation, as one of the Roman gods would just appear, but that he was actually flesh and blood. And so to prove this, they unwrapped the child to show there he was and all his naked.
Okay.
That was one of the reasons.
Very good. Thank you, Mary. That's very good. I'm glad to have an explanation.
The other comment on that, which we were told, was the fact that he came into the world with nothing.
Yeah.
And the artist chose to come to the
world. Yeah, well, that's lovely, too. So, yes. Okay, we're glad to have this brisk defense of the attack.
Well, is there any record that anyone else was present at the birth, as there must have been?
Ah, no, there isn't. And the reason that this brings up a very interesting story. Where did the idea of the late night arrival come from? Well, at the end of the second century, about the year 200, somebody wrote what can best be called a Christian novel. We now call it the Apocryphal Gospel of James. But it was somebody who just had a good imagination, and they were not Palestinian. They knew nothing about the bits and pieces of geography or even what the countryside was like, and wrote this novel. And about every page, there is a verse of scripture, and then there's all the rest of it is just a very colorful imagination. The novel was widely read. It has survived into the 20th century in Latin, Greek, Georgian, Armenian, Arabic, Coptic, Syriac, and Ethiopian. I mean, it was translated into all the various Christian languages in the Middle East. So in this, we have, by this time, Joseph has got the children of his previous marriage with him. The tradition that he was previously married and that he had children. So the perpetual virginity of Mary becomes a theme in the story. And Mary is on a donkey. This is where the donkey appears. So halfway between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, they find themselves in the middle of a desert. We don't have any deserts up there on the ridge, but never mind. And then Mary says, the child is pressing to come forth. I mean, you've got to do something because the child is just about to be born. Joseph goes off to Bethlehem to get the midwife, and in the meantime, the child is born. No witnesses. Why? Because by this time you now have a hypostasis in the church and no one sees the mystery of the Word becoming flesh. Even the faithful. So how could there have been witnesses to the initial event? Impossible. So it happens with no one around. So the midwife shows up and then she comes out of the cave after the baby's born. And Salome suddenly shows up. Now, we're not told what Salome and where she came from. Suddenly, there's Salome's right there. And the midwife says, this is a marvelous thing. A virgin has given birth. And she is, in every sense, still a virgin. And Salome says, that's not possible. She's had a baby. Oh, yes, it is. So then the two women go back in, and there's two accounts. One is that the midwife does it, and the other is that Salome does it. They have a little gynecological examination to see whether or not this is still the case. And they find that in every sense, Mary is still a virgin. And then Salome's hand starts falling off, burning with fire, because she dared question this miraculous event. And then an angel appears and says, touch the child. And so she reaches out and touches the child, and she is healed. And the story goes on. All kinds of wonderful things happen. Wonderful, wonderful things happen. Now, here we have the late night arrival myth. Eastern Orthodoxy has picked up various bits and pieces out of the story and celebrate them. We've got a name for the mother of Mary, Anna, she's called, and the name of the father of Mary and how Mary grew up in the temple and all of that and so on. So the Church of St. Anne is right next to the temple in Jerusalem because of this story, because of this novel. But the bits and pieces of the novel in our Western tradition have completely disappeared except for this one item, which is the late night arrival myth. There is one 5th century text called Codex Beza, which changes it, saying, rather than, and while they were there, her days were fulfilled, they have written, as she arrived, her days were fulfilled. Well, Codex Beza was a little sharper than we are, in the sense that they realized the way they were reflecting on and understanding and celebrating the story didn't match the text. So they changed the text. Well, we celebrate it in a way that doesn't match the text, and we don't even notice. So So, but that's the only text, one 5th century text, to fiddle with it, to have it sort of match the novel. But other than that, why? So these bits and pieces have got some of them traced clear back to this novel from about the year 200.
Is that where the Quran got their idea?
Which idea?
Well, I mean that it was out, you know, under a palm tree.
Under a palm tree. No, we don't know where that palm tree came from. We really don't know where that came from. There were lots of, we call them birth story apocryphal gospel that circulated in the 4th and 5th century. A lot of people wrote novels about this. And some of those, we do have one place where one of these apocryphal gospels shows up in the Quran. The bit of Jesus taking clay, turning it into forming them into birds, blowing on them, and then they fly away. That's in one of the apocryphal gospels, and it ends up in the Quran. So that one we can trace. We don't have any apocryphal gospel that's got a palm tree in it, so we don't know where that came from. But quite likely, one of these.
You were mentioning a desert, you see, that might be an oasis.
No, there's no, the apocryphal gospel of Jane has no palm trees in it. She just finds this cave. The cave bit is quite likely authentic in that, and also the traditional site in Bethlehem, I have no quarrel with at all. I think it's quite likely authentic in that you have some of you have no doubt been there, the very front of it is a small cave, the back of it is all masonry. Quite often village people in Palestine start off with a bit of a cave and they build a kind of a part of a house out in front of it. And so you have a cave which is a cave house, and in fact Dolman has a whole bunch of pictures of people who were living in caves, but they just turned the cave into their house. And they had built a mastaba right in the middle of it so that they would have the animals on one level, themselves on the other level. I perceive that this reading of the story enormously enriches it. Because you no longer have the mean old innkeeper, but rather you have the common people heard him gladly, which is what we have in the Gospels. And you have a story in which Jesus is born in a simple peasant home in the way that simple peasant folk have been born for the last 200 to 300,000 years in the Middle East.